Coming up, how flight paths are being affected by the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 in Ukraine.
But first, to the crisis in the Middle East. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Cairo, Egypt, along with the UN's Ban Ki-moon and Egyptian leaders, pressing for a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. Here's Secretary of State Kerry.
The loss of lives and the humanitarian impact is really heartbreaking. And we're joining our international partners in reiterating our call for an immediate end to the fighting and a return to the ceasefire that was reached in 2012.
But for now, the fighting continues. NPR's Emily Harris joins us from Gaza. Emily, what is it like there today?
Well, it depends a lot on where you are, Jeremy. In Gaza City, most of the shops are still closed. There are some places where, you know, a market is busy, things like that. But most people are still sticking largely to home. You can go around the city and then, you know, boom, all of a sudden something next to you has been struck. There'll be an explosion. You hear rockets shooting off overhead. They make a kind of a whooshing sound, which is a really different from the sound of incoming artillery, which is more like a thud, or an airstrike, which is a big explosion. We were down in a town south of here, Deir al-Balah, earlier today, visiting a hospital that was struck in an Israeli attack yesterday, and there was shelling going on around there fairly regularly, so you'd hear thuds on a regular basis. But also there, same kind of street situation. Most of the shops shuttered, their metal doors closed, so the shop fronts aren't even showing. But some areas of some market areas with donkey carts selling oranges or things like that, and some people out walking around. But nothing at all like the usual busy streets in Gaza.
And it doesn't sound, from what you're saying, like the airstrikes have lessened much at all since the ground invasion began.
No, the airstrikes haven't stopped since the ground war began. Gaza, as you know, is a really skinny place. It's between 4 and 7 miles wide, right along the Mediterranean here. And the eastern mile and a half are basically a no-go zone, although people are still in some areas in that area. But there's a lot of fighting in the eastern part from what we can tell. But the airstrikes continue not only in Gaza City, but up and down the strip as well.
And before the ground invasion, we know that the Israelis were often calling people before airstrikes were launched. Are people getting that kind of warning? Are they being asked to leave their homes before rockets are fired in?
Israel uses a number of different methods to warn people. They don't always use these methods, but methods that they've used at different parts of this conflict are dropping leaflets around neighborhoods telling people to leave. Sometimes they've given a specific deadline. In one case, they actually gave some specific places of where to go to be safe. Sometimes families get a call saying specifically leave this building right away. They also have something called the knock on the roof, which is a rocket that doesn't actually explode. But if it hits, it can go through a floor.
Right.
But then that's supposed to be a message to leave. You know, people don't always want to leave, though. I mean, they're leaving their home. They're leaving their home to who knows what. Some people don't know where to go. If their whole family's in one neighborhood, where are they going to go? And the schools here where people have sought shelter are really overcrowded.
Well, and we should be clear, it's not as if they can leave Gaza, right? There's a fence all the way around. You can't leave.
That's correct. There's a fence to the east. There's concrete wall to the north and the south. And no, and that's one of the issues that the militants here say they are trying to change as they are fighting Israel. They say they're trying to loosen what they call the blockade of Gaza. And when the Muslim Brotherhood was in charge in Egypt, it was easier to get out through Egypt. Over the past year, that government in Egypt obviously changed, and the border crossing into Egypt has been closed much of this past year, and that's put a lot of pressure on people in the Gaza Strip.
Emily, are Palestinians in Gaza hoping for a ceasefire, as the U.S. is?
Most people here that I've spoken to would like to see this fighting end. People have lost their homes. People have lost friends. People have lost loved ones. Business, as usual, has stopped. And this is the third war, the second one with a ground invasion that they've been involved in since late 2008. However, people also are very unhappy with the status quo. The restrictions on travel, as we spoke about, the restrictions on trade with the rest of the world, they would very, very much like a different life here. And some people I have spoken to do feel the only way to get that message across is to fight Israel.
Emily, I want to ask you one more thing, and that is that there is this report of an Israeli soldier missing. Now, we're not sure where that stands at this point, but as somebody who's covered this region for a long time, would that ratchet things up if the Israelis think that Hamas is holding one of their soldiers?
That could very well have an effect on both military action on the ground and political action as a discussion of ceasefire takes place. Hamas kidnapped an Israeli soldier and held him for 5 years. He was released in 2011. His name was Gilad Shalit. And in exchange, Hamas got more than 1,000 people released from Israeli prisons. Yes, an Israeli soldier, dead or alive, could potentially have an effect as a bargaining chip. It could also potentially step up military operations if Israel's on the ground here to try to find that soldier. We haven't seen any proof of life from Hamas yet. They did claim they have kidnapped an Israeli soldier and showed some identification. Israel today acknowledged that they do have a soldier missing. But again, we have no idea if there is an alive Israeli soldier, if Hamas just has the identification. So the details of exactly what happened to that soldier that Israel says is missing are still unclear.
NPR's Emily Harris speaking with us from Gaza. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
The conflict in Gaza and Israel is now affecting international travel. The Federal Aviation Administration is barring flights to Tel Aviv for the next 24 hours due to reports that a rocket landed near the city's Ben-Gurion airport. And earlier today, Delta Airlines rerouted a flight from Tel Aviv to Paris. This news comes as airlines are still avoiding a different airspace, the one above eastern Ukraine, because of the Malaysia Airlines passenger jet shot down there last week. Before that crash, there were warnings issued about flying in the airspace above eastern Ukraine, but those warnings only applied to the space up to 32,000 feet. The Malaysia Airlines jet was flying 1,000 feet higher and was only near, not in, the restricted space when it was shot down. Malaysian officials say they had been being cautious. But the accident is raising a lot of questions about airline flight paths and what kind of restrictions are placed over war zones. Captain John Ransom is a retired pilot who now works at the Washington, D.C.-based airline consulting firm Safety Operating Systems, and he joins us via Skype. And Captain Ransom, based on the flying you did as a pilot, would you describe how flight paths are planned?
Nowadays, it's done by computer, and the computer takes into account the weight of the airplane, takes into account the best winds, where there's going to be potentially hazardous weather, where actually the cheapest air traffic control fees might be. On top of that, there might be issues with potential warning areas that could affect the flight. And most of the flight planning software now takes into account all prohibited areas, puts it into the mix so that flights are routed around those as opposed to inadvertently through one.
In most cases, are airlines trying to find the most cost-effective route, meaning the ones that will require the least amount of fuel, but also factoring in safety?
Absolutely. And it's not just fuel. As I mentioned earlier, it could be air traffic control fees. I'm familiar with one airline who avoided one particular control for years because their air traffic control fees were much higher than going slightly out of their way on a slightly less direct route, saved them a bunch in handling fees.
When a warning is issued to airlines to avoid a war zone, how does that get factored into the flight plan? Is there just a circuitous route?
Yes, the flight planning software generally will look at the boundaries of that airspace and make sure that the flight doesn't go through any part of it. Unfortunately, sometimes the flights are already airborne when a warning is issued.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, I had a friend a few weeks ago who was flying from Dubai to Cologne, and once he got airborne, the fighting in Crimea picked up. So they closed that airspace, and the company got in touch with them, and they had to go through Turkey's airspace. It was kind of a last-minute deal, but they had plenty of fuel, even though the new flight plan took them slightly off their normal course.
But a mid-air detour that the pilot wasn't expecting when he took off from the runway.
Right. I had one of those, actually. I was flying from Seoul, Korea to Almaty, Kazakhstan, and we got airborne, and as we approached Chinese airspace, we were told that the airspace had been closed due to the 60th anniversary celebration of Chinese communism. So that threw us all into a little bit of a tizzy. There were a bunch of carriers that were trying to get into the airspace. And when they realized they hadn't posted enough warning, the Chinese opened their airspace again and let us through.
When it comes to war zones and potential military conflict, who's making the decision to close an airspace? Is it the airlines? Is it the countries?
Usually the countries, especially the FAA, respond pretty quickly by issuing a prohibition to fly through airspace. But most of the times the airlines are paying attention as well. They have a keen interest in keeping their flights safe. So sometimes it's a dead heat on who closes the airspace to their flights.
Many people were surprised when this Malaysia Airlines passenger jet was shot down because they weren't aware that there were weapons in the hands or even weapons available that could shoot a passenger jet down that had been at that height. Do you think that flight planners are going to be more likely to consider the possibility that missiles with that kind of reach could be in the possession of rebel groups in other parts of the world and adjust flight plans accordingly?
I think after the Malaysian disaster, flight planning organizations around the world are going to take another look at how they do route airplanes to make sure that they don't take them anywhere close to where something like this could potentially happen again.
Captain Ransom, we read that the Israeli carrier, El Al, equips its planes with sensors to detect when radars lock on them as targets so they can evade. Now, the Malaysia Airlines jet did not have that. But could the crew have seen the missile coming on its radar?
No. The crew has weather avoidance radar. It's only a look-ahead radar. And the closing speed between the missile and the airplane was probably between 2,000 or 3,000 miles an hour. So they had no chance to react at all.
If you were still flying actively today, do you think you would change the way you fly in any way based on this?
I think I might be a little more aware before the flights when I'm looking through. Usually there's pages and pages of warnings and prohibitions. I'd probably pay a lot more attention to those than I have in the past.
Captain John Ransom is a retired pilot who now works at Safety Operating Systems. Captain Ransom, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's not a brain tumor, is it?
I'm dyslexic. Dude, you learn to read when you're six. That's first grade. And they separate you into these levels. They don't tell you that's what they're doing. But everyone knows who's in the smart group and who's in the dumb one.
On average, one or two children in every U.S. classroom has dyslexia, a learning disability that makes reading difficult, sometimes painfully so, as that clip we just heard from the TV show Glee suggests. But new research is showing that it's possible to detect signs of dyslexia in the brain even before kids learn to read. And as WBUR's Rachel Zimmerman from the Here Now Contributors Network explains, that could influence how educators help dyslexic students.
Sixth grader Josh Tebow has been struggling to read for as long as he can remember. He has yet to complete a single Harry Potter book, his personal goal. As part of a research study at Boston Children's Hospital on the genetics of dyslexia, Josh has undergone regular brain scans since first grade.
When we first started, I'm like, oh no, you're setting me into like some strange like science lab where I'm going to be like injected with needles and I'm never going to see my family again.
In the past, and sometimes even today, kids who struggle to read have been thought to lack motivation or smarts. Now it's clear that's not true. Dyslexia stems from physiological differences in the brain's circuitry. Those differences can make it harder for children to process the basic components of language. And it's much more complex than just flipping your B's and D's. Learning to read involves mapping the sounds of spoken language, the k, the a, the t, to their corresponding letters, and then understanding how those letter symbols, the C, A, and T, can create words with meaning. Kids with dyslexia have far more trouble mastering these steps automatically. Josh Tebow understands that his brain works differently than many of his peers. Some kids still don't get it.
There was a student that came up and said, "Are you stupid?" Because my brain was working in a different way, and I'm just like, "No, I am not stupid. I am just dyslexic."
For many children, the path toward reading is often marked by academic struggle and social stigma. But current collaborations between neuroscientists at MIT and Boston Children's Hospital may mark a fundamental shift in addressing dyslexia. Neuroscientist Nadine Gobb of Children's Hospital theorizes that even at birth or shortly after, children's brain structures can show signs of developing the disorder. Her hope is that ultimately the current research will trickle down to classrooms and help eliminate what she calls the dyslexia paradox.
Several studies have suggested that intervention is most effective in kindergarten or first grade. However, you have to have several years of reading failure before you can get a diagnosis of dyslexia, the end of second grade, beginning of third grade. So we have this paradox here.
The researchers are finding that scanning the brains of kindergartners can help improve predictions of how the children will master reading later on. Using cutting-edge MRI technology, the scientists are able to pinpoint a specific neural pathway that appears to be related to dyslexia. It's called the arcuate fasciculus.
It's an arch-shaped bundle of fibers that connects the frontal language areas of the brain to the areas in the temporal lobe that are important for language.
Elizabeth Norton, a neuroscientist at MIT's McGovern Institute for Brain Research, says we're not quite ready to simply take a picture of your child's brain and say, aha, this kid is going to have dyslexia. But we're getting closer to that point.
We see that in children who in kindergarten already have strong pre-reading scores, their arcuate fasciculus is both bigger and more well-organized. So we can see a child with a score of 0 has a very small and not particularly well-organized arcuate fasciculus.
Maybe the most surprising aspect of the research so far is how clear a signal we see in the brains of children who are likely to go on to be poor readers.
MIT neuroscientist John Gabrielli says that if the kindergarten study's brain imaging and other metrics prove to be predictive, new questions will arise.
The bigger challenges for us now soon will be to figure out what kind of interventions can be done in a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old that might put her or him on a different pathway altogether. You know, can we have a child arrive at school who'll be ready to read and not wait for failure at all, but have intervened so early that the child never experiences that failure at all?
The point of early identification, says Gabrielli, is to help kids avoid the stigma of dyslexia.
The social downsides to late identification are quite severe. These children who struggle to read are very aware of where they stand relative to their peers.
Yes.
Yes.
I would be chased down the hallway. This one boy, he's like, you should know how to read by now. You're in seventh grade.
Caitlin, Lily, Sarah, and Aisha are eighth graders at the Carroll School, a private school that specializes in language-based learning disabilities. The girls told me about some of the strategies they used to keep their dyslexia a secret.
I can't see it, I have glasses. That's what I used to say.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, I just lost my place, and then I would skip that word, and hopefully no one would realize and call me on it, so.
I used to just, like, mumble over the word or, like, say it really quietly and pretend like I said it.
When you talk to an eighth grader who struggled for 9 years in a general educational environment, she spent a great deal of effort trying to figure out how to do something that was really difficult for her. A small intervention early on could potentially have a huge, huge impact on a person's life.
Dr. Eric Falk is director of cognitive interventions and research at the Carroll School. He says Carroll is ready to start earlier intervention right now.
Here's the bottom line. It's like, we've wanted to do this for many years, and we are ready to start a kindergarten if there's enough interest from the community.
So wouldn't it be great if all kids with dyslexia could get support, like very small classes and one-on-one individualized tutoring much earlier, and not just those lucky enough to go to specialized private schools?
When we started these studies, we approached a lot of school districts throughout New England. And some of these schools were really open and happy that we want to come and test every incoming kindergartner.
But Nadine Gobb, lead investigator on the kindergarten study, told me she was surprised to discover that not all schools were on board.
We also had districts who said, I'm sorry, but we don't want you, because if MIT and Harvard diagnoses or identifies children at risk in kindergarten, and we don't have the resources to do anything about this, then parents will get really upset with us, and we would feel very guilty as well.
As this research becomes more definitive, it will remain an open question whether schools are able to take advantage of the science to test kids and intervene much earlier. Researchers aren't proposing that every kindergartner get an MRI, but they say if a child has a family history of dyslexia or exhibits signs of reading trouble, the cost of an early diagnostic brain scan may be far less than the price of playing catch-up after years of academic failure. I'm Rachel Zimmerman.
When our neuroscience series continues tomorrow, we'll hear about research finding that child abuse, sexual abuse, and neglect can damage developing brains.
What the brain research is telling us is this stuff has biological reality. That's a game changer.
Apple's quarterly earnings report comes out later today, and analysts are expecting to see about a 15% uptick in iPhone sales over last year. But the big question for Apple is, what's next? And we're getting a little more details about that today. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us now. And Jason, the Journal is reporting today that Apple is ordering a whole lot of new, bigger iPhones. Tell us about that.
Bigger, much bigger. Hi, Jeremy. That's right. We're reporting that they're planning to come out with, and it's most likely going to be in September, phones that have 5.1 in that range of screen size, which is significantly bigger than the ones now, and that makes them a lot more like their main competitor these days, Samsung, which has, to many people's eyes, like huge phones.
And how would they compare to those Samsung phones, by the way?
Well, they're about the same size. It's pretty close because, in fact, I've got a Samsung Galaxy phone, the S5 phone, which it would be competing with, the Apple phone would be competing with, and it's about the same size.
And we knew that Apple was going to go bigger, or at least that's the rumor. Of course, with Apple, it's always a rumor that kind of gets repeated so many times. Somebody finds, you know, a prototype in some bar in Silicon Valley, and it goes to a website, and we find out a little more. So we knew that, but what you're reporting today is that they're actually ordering a lot of these phones compared to previous orders from the manufacturers, presumably in China.
That's right. And we're reporting that Apple is asking suppliers to make between 70 and 80 million iPhone 6s that have these bigger screens. So they'll be either 4.7 inches diagonally or 5.5 inches. So really big phone. So I correct myself. That's bigger than the phone that I'm carrying around right now.
Well, and that compares, by the way, to 50 to 60 million of the previous iteration of the iPhone last year. That's how many they had ordered of those. But that does presume that they are really expecting some good sales of these iPhone 6s.
Yeah, I think what they're looking at is the larger market, and there's a statistic that really astounded me. Listen to this. 98% of Android smartphones sold globally that are, you know, that cost more than $400, right? So the higher end ones, 98% of them have screens that are bigger than 5 inches. So people want the big screens. I can tell you that. And I made the switch myself to an Android phone because I wanted to have a larger screen. But one of the things I think is going to be interesting to watch here is that, you know, the other, you know, real fire hose of revenue for Apple is, of course, the iPad, right?
Right.
And that's one of the things we look at when these, you know, when the revenues come in. I'm wondering whether the bigger phone is going to cannibalize sales of the iPad. I know it's done that for me. I'm not using an iPad anymore. I decided to sell mine. In fact, if you want to buy it, it's for sale on Craigslist. But and I shouldn't be using this time for advertising my own wares. But I feel like it's, you know, it's a sufficient size that I can read magazines, newspapers, and I can be a one device guy.
So the phone takes over where the tablet is no longer needed, and I don't even know what happens to the term phablet then, Jason.
The term phablet, exactly. Well, they keep coming more and more fab. And, you know, it's sort of funny that I was reading up about what Samsung's plans is because, you know, they're always trying to one-up one another. And, you know, Apple, when they come out their phone, it most certainly is going to have that sleek style, that metallic casing. That's what we're reporting. It's going to have that same metallic casing that everyone loves in the latest version of the iPhone. And now Samsung, they're planning, according to rumors online, they're planning to do their own metallic case so they can catch up.
Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal. And Jason, by the way, when are we expecting these iPhone 6s to hit the market?
Well, they usually come out in September, so at least that's when the announcements are made. But we'll have to see. They've ordered a whole bunch of them. That's what we know right now.
Jason, thanks so much.
Time to start waiting in line.
And a quick check now on some of the other stories we're following around the country. The Los Angeles Times reports today that the first 6 months of 2014 were the hottest on record in California, nearly 5 degrees warmer than the average for the last century and a degree hotter than the record that was set back in 1934. That is January through June, by the way. It does not include this month, which has already been very hot in California, and a heat wave is expected later this week. Of course, none of this Good news for the state's historic drought, especially as we approach fire season. Meanwhile, in Chicago, officials are announcing today that they will install 8 new noise monitors in the areas around O'Hare International Airport. There are already 33 noise monitors, which capture noise from aircraft arrivals and departures, and city officials use that data to determine whether residents qualify for free soundproofing on their homes. A study out today from Spears Magazine and the consulting firm Wealth Insight finds that 1 in 25 New Yorkers is a millionaire. That puts the Big Apple in fourth place of 20 global cities based on the portion of their populations whose net worth tops $1 million, and that does not include the value of their primary residence. The top three spots, by the way, go to Monaco, Zurich, and Geneva. Houston and San Francisco, the only other U.S. cities besides New York to make the list. Houston is number 18. San Francisco is number 19. And in Miami, the Miami Herald is reporting that a Swedish biologist has spotted a red-necked stint in the Florida Keys, the first time ever this species has been seen in the Sunshine State. The red-necked stint is a tiny little bird in the sandpiper family. It breeds in northern Asia and western Alaska. It's known to winter in India and Taiwan. It's been spotted in the U.S., in New England, and New Jersey. And now it may be summering in Florida. So we'll keep an eye on that. Some of the other stories we're following for you today.
And now to Hong Kong. Earlier this month, hundreds of thousands of people marched through Hong Kong demanding full democracy. This was one of the largest protests in the former British colony since it was handed back over to China in 1997. The protesters want Beijing to honor its commitment to Hong Kong's political and judicial independence, and they're worried China has no intention of doing that. But there are also protesters on the other side. The BBC's Juliana Liu reports.
Chanting, "Hong Kong is our home," hundreds of protesters have gathered outside the Legislative Council or Parliament to support the Chinese government's version of political reform for the former British colony. Leading the demonstration of workers from a union loyal to the central government in Beijing is middle-aged taxi driver Lo Xiqing. He has taken sides in a fierce debate over the future of democracy in the city.
I have come out to protest because I want to make sure that political reforms are made under the official legal process. I want to express my ideas here peacefully. I reject those people who use violence to put forth their ideas.
These are the pro-democracy activists Mr. Lo opposes, but they're hardly violent. Lung Kwa Kung, a veteran lawmaker, is heckling Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's second most powerful government official, in a cavernous chamber located deep inside Parliament. He is dragged out by security, all the while shouting he wants the public to nominate the city's next leader. Ms. Lam calmly continues addressing the other lawmakers on electoral reform. She's used to this kind of noisy opposition, which mirrors the widening divide between pro-democracy rebels and those loyal to the Chinese government. At issue is how the city's mayor, called the chief executive, will be chosen. China has already said it will allow one person, one vote in 3 years, but it wants to approve the list of candidates on the ballot. Activists want the public to choose whoever they like. Driving the political tussle and potential crisis is rising social discontent. I've taken the train to an area just one stop away from mainland China to find out why locals are increasingly upset. The landmark North Shopping Center in the Shangshui neighborhood is packed with shoppers from China, pulling suitcases filled with baby products, packaged foods, and personal care items like shampoo. Many of them won't be taking it all home. Instead, after they return to the mainland, they'll sell everything for profit.
Well, the
products that everyone around me is snapping up are cheaper and of better quality than in China. Items like tins of baby milk powder are in particular demand because of recent scandals there. It's difficult to say exactly how many traders do this regularly, but they probably account for the bulk of the 24 million people last year who visited for just one day, raising prices and transforming this once sleepy district into a giant shopping mall. The anger has fueled a peaceful rebellion against growing Chinese influence. Leading the fight is a group of teenage students who, along with their university counterparts, organized a sit-in right here in the main business district 2 weeks ago. More than 500 people were arrested. Agnes Chow speaks for the group, called Scholarism.
We are planning to have a bigger civil disobedience action in August, and we want to fight for the civil nomination rights.
But why civil disobedience? You're essentially talking about an illegal demonstration, and you're inviting arrest.
By civil disobedience action, we want to show that our whole political system and even our law is unjust, that it can protect the basic rights of Hong Kong people.
Just a short walk away in Parliament, the pro-China demonstrators are continuing their protest. It's shaping up to be an unprecedented summer of simmering unease in Hong Kong.
That's the BBC's Juliana Liu reporting from Hong Kong.
Earlier this year, we brought you the story of a little boy whose remains were discovered in Montana back in the 1960s, and it turned out the boy was buried there more than 12,000 years ago. He was studied, and the research told us a lot about Native Americans, and he has now been reburied. Joining us from Montana are Sarah Anzik, she was one of the researchers who analyzed the remains, and Shane Doyle, a member of the Crow Nation who teaches in the Native American Studies program at Montana State University. Shane helped the researchers deal with the sensitive issue of handling Native American remains. Sarah and Shane, welcome to both of you. And Sarah, can you just start off by reminding us of the significance of this child's remains?
Yeah, so this child was actually identified in 1968 on the property of my parents in Wilson, Montana. And the child was found in association with over 100 stone and non-human bone tools that are consistent technologically with the Clovis generation. And the Clovis are at one point determined to be the first Americans. But however, we do know now that there's evidence that there is a pre-Clovis generation out there as well. And they were in existence from the archaeological record demonstrates that they were present in the Americas, actually only North American continent, from approximately 12,600 years before present to around 13,000 years before present. And the carbon dating on the Anzik remains was approximately 12,600 years old, so it was just at the end of the Clovis period. And that's approximately when the megafauna and the larger mammoth at that point had disappeared.
Hmm. Sarah, what have we learned about Native Americans and about the Clovis culture because of this boy?
So actually, we learned quite a bit. Because the Clovis period was short-lived, it was really unknown who the Clovis people were. They could have actually represented a culture who might have disappeared and not really left any descendants. So the genome sequencing of the Clovis individual really shed light and insight into who are these people, and they are the ancestors to essentially all Native Americans living in the Americas. They're most closely related, at least Anzik is most closely related to a southern branch. We see a deep divergence between the tribes represented by the northern tribes up in Canada and then the south and central tribes. We do not have any genomes from the United States tribes, so we don't really know where those fit, but Anzik fits just on the base of that southern branch.
And there was some controversy about all this. Shane, let me bring you in, and can you just tell us about some of the controversy about researching this boy before what happened last month, which was that he was reburied? There were some people that were upset.
Well, yeah, I think there's always going to be controversy when you study ancient human remains, especially in Native America. You know, there's such a history of abuse, I think, historically speaking, in the 20th century, 19th and 20th century, of American Indian skeletons just being kept as research items rather than being respected as individual people with families and people in those families who wish that they could be respected and buried in a proper way. So this research did kind of, you know, cross lines in terms of what some people thought was appropriate. But overall, I think the people who have been involved with this now here in Montana, the American Indians who have been involved with the repatriation and reburial, they see the value, I think, of the science. And, you know, they have mixed feelings about all of it. But overall, I think they believe it's a positive step.
Now, you were both at the reburial. Shane, let me start with you. What was it like?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was a beautiful ceremony. There was a lot of people who participated, both American Indians and non-Indians. And I felt like it was a healing experience for all of us who were there and involved.
Sarah?
Yeah, for me, it was probably one of the most amazing days I've ever experienced. It was a moment of closure. It was peaceful. It was unity. And even though it rained throughout most of the ceremony, it didn't matter. It meant that much more. It was quite a spectacular day.
Sarah, the last time we talked to you, you said that this little boy's remains were discovered because he had a story to tell. Was this the end of his story, do you think?
This is the end of his story and its closure. And as I did say that, I felt that he's a gift, you know, for us to learn from. And he has given us an incredible gift. And so now is the time to return that gift to this child and return him to the ground. And that's what we've done. And so it feels really good.
I know there were members of several tribes at the ceremony. Shane, what do you think the reburial meant for them?
Well, it was very significant to members of several different tribes, especially members of the Kennewick tribes who attended the ceremony. As you recall, the Kennewick man was a controversial point of study back in the late 1990s and continues to be so. But there is currently a study undergoing right now on the Kennewick man, and the intention is to have him reburied as well in the same way that this little boy was. So this reburial, having it happen, seeing it come to fruition full circle, really gave people a lot of hope that the Kennewick man would also be treated with the same respect.
Sarah, what are you going to be researching now that that the story of the Anzac child has come to a close?
Yeah, so actually this whole experience and research was really done outside of my day job. Took a lot of time away from my family as well as my day job, which is actually at the NIH down at Rocky Mountain Labs. So I never really did stop with my current job, and that's what I'll go back and put a lot more focus back into it.
Shane, what about on the research side of things? What do you make of what we've learned from this boy and what it means for the future of looking into the history of Native American tribes?
Well, this is very important in the whole research program here for Native American people and DNA research. I think it helps to build trust between researchers and tribal communities, and it's a step forward in a positive direction. I think once the trust is established and there's a community established there between researchers and American Indians, that we can move forward with getting DNA sequencing done for contemporary tribal people. And so this study here, this reburial, means a lot, not just to ancient people, but to contemporary research as well.
Is there a limited amount of DNA sequencing for contemporary tribal people?
In North America, there has been basically none. Tribes have not really been involved with it. They've kind of mostly rejected that kind of research. So this is an opportunity now to maybe rethink that whole thing.
That's Shane Doyle, a member of the Crow Nation who teaches in the Native American Studies program at Montana State University. We've also been speaking with Sarah Anzac. The remains of the so-called Clovis boy were discovered on her parents' ranch in 1968, and she was one of the researchers who analyzed those remains, and they were both at the reburial last month. Sarah and Shane, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And by the way, there's a song that Shane has sung for the young boy who was reburied last month. It's a traditional Cheyenne honor song. And when we spoke earlier this year, I asked him to sing it for us. That's Shane Doyle singing his honor song for the Clovis Boy. The boy's remains were reburied in Montana last month. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Here and Now.